I guess every rose has its thorn, just like every night has its dawn, just like every cowboy sings a sad, sad song. Every rose has its thorn.
What does that song do to you? I've heard it said before, and I've certainly felt it myself. Music is the magic in this life, and perhaps there is a way to understand the reasons why. Our next guest is the director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University, and her new book is out today, Transported: The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. And if you know what she means but have questions about the magic of it all, please join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR. Our guest, Elizabeth Margulis. And Elizabeth, I want to apologize to you for starting with poison today with our conversation.
You just had to really get into it right off the bat.
I'm taking you there right out of the gate. And it's really where your new book jumps off because of the way that this song, Every Rose Has Its Thorns, transports you.
Yeah, and regrettably for me, this is, you know, not the best adolescent memory. I hadn't thought about this or, you know, really encountered this song that I'd noticed in several decades when it started playing over the loudspeakers of a gym. And a deep feeling of shame started cascading through my limbs. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Closed my eyes. I wasn't in the gym anymore. I was back as a seventh grader in the rear part of a wood-paneled station wagon. I don't know if
I can relate to this so well. I think we're about the same age because I can take myself there too, Elizabeth.
I was there with a bunch of other friends. We were at a birthday party. This song was playing on the radio. And I was just feeling like I had done it. I'd made the leap to teenagerhood. I was here with a bunch of co-ed peers. I transferred from a Catholic school. I was suddenly so cool. And I decided that I was going to commit to this new vision of myself and just say a swear word. Yeah. So I did it. I was really in my feels, but it was, and the second it came out of my mouth, it was so clear that I'd miscalibrated. I looked around. There were just, the silence lasted a little too long. And one of my friends said, "Well, look at that. Goody two shoes. Elizabeth said a swear word." Yeah. And so the song really, you know, I had not thought about that in forever. And, you know, the song really brought it back in such vivid detail that I remembered kind of how my knees felt like knocking against the other kids in the back as we were being driven around. And that's, you know, really what I'm trying to think about with this notion of musical daydreams, is the way you can hear a song and suddenly find yourself somewhere else entirely.
The book is called Transported: The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. And I think to one degree or another, we've all experienced that. But you've looked at the study behind the science behind it, Elizabeth, and you found that there is an explanation. This isn't some feel good or, in your case, feel bad sort of magic. This is actually science of the way the brain works, and it kind of starts with what the brain does when it's not actually doing anything at all, right?
That's right. And, you know, that's an opportunity that we have increasingly less time for nowadays with all of the screens and social media and endless video feeds. Back in the day, and by back in the day, I mean like 10 years ago, right, best estimates were that we spent between a third and a fifth of our day in this kind of mind-wandering state. And what normally happens, so if you stick people in a scanner and look at what's happening in their brain in between when they're doing whatever the tasks are that the experiment asked them to do, you'll see this network called the default mode come online. And what that really seems to underlie is this kind of reflecting back, thinking about things that happened to you, projecting forward into the future, imagining scenarios that might be fictional or imaginative. It's all the kind of roving sense making that your brain is doing to have a firmer notion of who you are and how the parts of your life interrelate. So it's really actually critical to brain health, to function, to well-being. Mm-hmm. And seems to be increasingly rare.
So how does music fit into this default mode in our brains?
So we know that if I look at somebody in an MRI scanner while they're listening to a specific excerpt of music that they've never heard before, nevertheless, very specific patterns of activation for each excerpt will emerge in this default mode. And the way we were able to figure that out is through kind of this chain of studies that started outside the scanner and just in the world, where we played people excerpts of music they've never heard before and just asked them to freely describe to us what they imagined. And the expectation would be, you know, that reveries would be really subjective and personal and idiosyncratic, but that's not at all what we found. We found that person after person listening to something they've never heard before tended to produce highly similar descriptions for the same excerpts. So there's this really robust connection, actually, even though it feels like you aren't paying attention, between what's in the sound and what you actually end up imagining.
Yeah, one of the weirdest parts of your book to me was when you were making one of your classrooms listen to a musical piece, and when you asked them what sort of imaging it presented or what they thought about when they heard it, they were all saying pirates. And you thought, well, you guys are all copying each other, but really, it seems to be a shared sort of experience in music that we all have to some degree, or we all share inside our brain?
Exactly. So to me, what we're really looking at here is the way that music accrues these kinds of patterned associations over the course of our life. And we don't even know we're tracking all these statistics right. Of how music is paired with things in the world. And, across years and years and years, this amounts to this ability to hear something completely new and have really concrete associations with it.
Elizabeth Margulis, our guest, her new book out today, Transported: The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. So how, Elizabeth, do you define what a musical daydream is so we can recognize it in our own lives?
I think the easiest example here is the example I start the book with, and it comes from a movie. It's the final scene of La La Land. So you might remember the characters played by Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling mm-hmm. have in the past had this romance that ultimately failed. And at the end of the movie, we're far into the future. Emma Stone's character is happily married, wanders into a bar. It turns out to be the bar by this former boyfriend. And he, Ryan Gosling, sits down at the piano and starts playing this song. And it's the tune that he'd been playing when they first met. So as an audience, we watch, everything go black as soon as the notes start. And we're then just transported back to that initial encounter. We start reliving it along with the character as the music plays. And then it continues and builds into this whole fantasy of what their life could have been like if they stayed together. And then the music stops. This is really key. The second there's no more sound, the fantasy crumbles. Mm. We're just back in, this bar in this basement. And so this is really what I mean by musical daydream. Anytime you're listening to a song, you think you're just immersed somewhere completely different. It doesn't even maybe feel like you're listening to the music, you are nevertheless carried there by what's happening in the sound. So, as soon as that song stopped, the memory and the fantasy that she was sustaining just went away.
So does this happen to everybody? Because it happens to you, and I can relate to this. It certainly happens to me. I feel like music does something that I can't explain. I can't put it into words, and that's, to me, why we have music, because it takes us beyond language to another way of communicating, but also transporting ourselves, Elizabeth.
Yeah, there's a gamut. So there's like this range along the of intensity along which people experience this kind of phenomenon. And part of that has to do just with differences in mental imagery overall.
Okay.
So there's one, you might have heard about this in the last few years. There's been lots of interesting findings coming out about people with aphantasia who lack this inner mind's eye. So, you know, if you tell somebody that has aphantasia to picture a red apple, they can like think about properties of a red apple, like that, you know, it's crunchy and, you know, whatever, but not picture it in the way most people can. So those kinds of individual differences feed into how receptive people are to this kind of experience, but also the kind of training and enculturation you've had. So sometimes when people are really highly formally trained in music, there's this sense that it's really a failure to, you know, let your mind wander in this way, right? And that you're supposed to just be focusing and paying attention. So sometimes, if you've had a certain kind of training, as I went to music conservatory and studied
Right.
piano, and I really had to kind of train myself back out of some of that to regain this capacity. So yeah, it does vary.
Very interesting. So, director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University, what does this musical daydream mean about our cognition, the way we think, and how our brains work?
Yeah, so I'm excited about a couple of things here. One is just the way that, you know, we think of ourselves as individual cogitating units, like we have a brain and, you know, it's our brain and we're generating our thoughts and that's what's happening. And I think in this, the kind of collective shared aspect that emerges in this surprising way with musical daydreams, it shows us that there's a lot about what's going on in the world we build together that's shaping what we're capable of thinking about. And so I think it urges us to maybe conceptualize cognition in a broader kind of way that transcends just the individual. That's one thing.
Wow.
And secondly, I'm interested in what it says about music. So there's really interesting research about babies, for example, and like if you play them a song and, you know, in one of a couple of different ways, and then you don't play them the song again for like half a year, and you come back to them, they only care about that song that they heard if a parent had initially sung it to them in person. If they'd heard it in all kinds of other contexts in their life, they just don't care about it. So the idea is that music really carries information that's deeply social and contextual and just carries along with it lots of real world associations and just isn't really abstract in the way that we sometimes think about it.
Perhaps that helps explain to some degree why Yacht Rock always takes me back to the trauma of waiting in the dentist's office.
You know what? That's yes. So this is the thing. Honestly, there's dentist office songs like that can transport you there. Maybe not
Totally.
that desirable, but you other examples that I think are really easy to think about are like hotel bar
Sure.
music, or
Oh
wedding
my gosh.
reception music. Yeah.
I think I'm having a daydream as we speak, Elizabeth. You don't actually so you don't actually have to hear the song then, do you? Or you maybe just the thought of the song or
That's a really interesting question. I was talking with somebody about that last night, actually, because somebody was mentioning that they. So I was just describing aphantasia. There's also kind of a related situation that's less well studied, where people can't imagine sounds in their head. So that would mean like you can't hear through the music or kind of get music stuck in your head the way so many of us do. And they were saying, exactly like you're mentioning, that they nevertheless are really susceptible to these daydreams. So yeah, it suggests that it could, maybe it could go through just imagining. I don't know. That's not something we've tested ex
Yet.
expressly, but I wouldn't I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I'd be interested in knowing where your research is going. As while you're talking about it, I have to admit, I still have Every Rose Has Its Thorns going on somewhere in the back of my brain.
Well, at least it's less traumatizing for you, hopefully.
As far as you know, Elizabeth.
Normally, people do have a known reminiscence bump for music that they listen to in their teenage years. They tend to like it more, tend to have more memories associated with it. But usually, those are positive memories. So that's a good thing. They can be positive. They're often self-defining. They relate to kind of your identity and who you are. So yeah, I would just say normally it's like a more positive transportation than the example that I have provided.
And I made you live through once again with apologies, and now it's stuck in my head like an earworm.
That seems fair.
Yeah, I think I did it to myself. Elizabeth Margulis is the director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. Her new book about the magic of music is called Transported, the Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. It's out today, and our conversation continues. Next, if you have a question, 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. Join us tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show as we take a look at the oversized role Wisconsin may be playing in the loss of biodiversity. We'll also visit the Clean Marina in Port Washington, and we'll talk to a mycologist who reveals the power of mushrooms in your garden. That's tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show from 11 to 1. Our guest now is Elizabeth Margulis. She's the director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University, also a professor, and her new book out today is Transported, the Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. Perhaps you already know what she means. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to Tim in Door County. Tim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good, sir. What are you hearing in your head?
I am very curious as to why we get songs stuck in our head. Mm-hmm. And why we really can't get them out. You just repeat yourself over and over and over again. You try not to, but it keeps coming back.
Don't I know it? And Elizabeth Margulis, you talk about this in your new book. What do we know about earworms?
Great question. Well, I think the first thing I'd say about earworms is that they're incredibly normal. So more than 90% of people report getting them pretty frequently. And a couple things. The fact that music tends to get stuck in our head really distinguishes it from other kind of phenomena. So we don't tend to get clips of speech, for example, stuck in our head quite as easily. Tunes that get stuck in our head tend to be the ones we've heard recently, that we've heard repeatedly. And then furthermore, they can be triggered by really oblique kind of cues. So an example of this is like you're jogging and you didn't really even notice that you went by a dog behind a fence that was barking. And before you know it, Who Let the Dogs Out is playing on replay in your head. And so there's been a lot of research about like which kinds of songs tend to get stuck most frequently. And the catchiest songs seem to be the ones that are pretty predictable in one sense. Like they do something pretty standard for a while, and then they have some kind of hook or some kind of surprise. But I will tell you that one fun strategy you could try for dislodging them is chewing gum. There's good evidence that can get rid of an earworm. Yes.
Well, the brain is a wonderful thing, but with the research you've done into musical daydreams, what can be done with that, Elizabeth? How can we use the science that you've put together here to make this somehow useful, perhaps medicinal, therapeutic?
Yeah, there are a number of both kind of everyday uses and clinical applications. Maybe I'll start by focusing on some of the latter. So there's a lot of anecdotal evidence and some growing scientific evidence that people experiencing dementia can benefit from listening to music that they loved when they were an adolescent, that even into early and mid-stage Alzheimer's, that the memories cued by these songs can be preserved in ways that are really robust and helpful, because it really brings back this sense of, you know, who you are and what's important to you. And there's some evidence that that increased kind of awareness continues past the end point of the song for some short period thereafter, which is really promising. And then another thought has to do with the way that we tend to use music in our lives all the time, pretty intuitively, as a device for mood regulation. So, you know, if you're feeling down, lots of people will give you advice like, well, you just need, you know, you need to stop ruminating. You're like stuck on these same thoughts. You need to go outside and take a walk. But sometimes that's too much, you know, to wrestle together. But if you can just press play on a song and really kickstart a whole different internal thoughtscape, that's a powerful kind of intervention as well.
Yeah, yeah, that is therapy, right? For at least for my ears, that's a way to daydream. It's a way to go somewhere else. It's a way to get away from your ruminating or reoccurring thoughts, your obsessive, you know, brain, and sort of go to that default mode.
Exactly. And there's this really interesting way that that's been thought about and used in music therapy over the past couple decades, starting with an inspiration from research on psychedelics. Huh. So there was this researcher, Helen Bonney, and she sat in on all these sessions where people were being administered LSD and kind of taken on this trip in this kind of, you know, healing context. And she noticed that what people were imagining during these sessions seemed to be closely related to what songs were playing. And she was like, what if we just like forget about the drugs and just play people music? And so she started this whole technique called the Bonney Method of Guided Imagery to Music that's still used today on multiple continents to kind of treat all kinds of mental health issues.
Wow. So comparing it or testing music with psychedelic drugs, and then you found when you took the psychedelic drugs away that in many ways the experience could still be the same?
Yeah, I really feel that music is this kind of under-acknowledged little mini psychedelic, you know, experience that's peppered throughout our lives. And it's funny because we kind of tend to not pay attention to these daydreams, right? And I think it's only when you start realizing how closely related they are to the music, does the full kind of trippiness of things start to reveal itself?
Let's go to Tom in Superior next. Tom, good afternoon.
Hello, what an interesting program. My apologies for not catching all of it. I am curious as to little idiosyncrasies such as hearing a hi-hat open and close twice on a rest when you hear a piece of music, or having some sort of internal indigenous rhythm. I mean, I grab onto daily things. I don't mean things that we might all encounter or might actually associate, like a turn signal going click, 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 right on that 1.5 interval or whatever they are. Mm-hmm, but just mm-hmm. I will pick rhythms out of things that don't seem to really have rhythm, and it's kind
yes.
of strange. Now, I am a musical
yes.
person. I am a musical
yes.
person, but I'm focused a lot on what's not there, I think,
right.
as much. And there are other people like this. I've talked, and we don't seem to be overly nervous or overly, you know, high-strung or anything, generally speaking.
No.
Sometimes quite the opposite.
No, that's a really widespread phenomenon as well, called subjective rhythmicization,
huh.
where, you know, if you've ever, I think the blinker is maybe the most familiar example where, you know, some shift happens and it seems like the blinker is rocking out, right?
It's dropping beats.
Yeah, and that's actually been studied quite a bit in the lab. And one of the things that tends to engender that kind of shift in perception is repetitiveness. So if there's like, you know, water dripping in this really repetitive way, that can seem to transform to some kind of beat and song. So yes, that there's no index there whatsoever of neuroses or anything astray.
Elizabeth, with the research in your new book, what do you still want to learn? We've got about a minute and a half here, but what keeps you curious about your work?
Yeah, well, one of the most interesting adventures we've had with this project is collecting data across cultures around the world. And that's an area that we're really pushing on now and trying to really understand this phenomenon in its full variability as it occurs in, you know, for lots of different people and lots of different kinds of communities.
Like the example in your classroom when you played the piece of music that everybody was like, I hear pirates. Is this a cultural thing or is this a universal human experience? Is that
exactly? And we're finding that we get within cultures this kind of collective shared imagining to new excerpts, but it doesn't really convey across cultures. So this is really a way of tracing kind of the exposures that we've had across our lifetime.
And so we've still got a lot to learn about our relationship with music then, don't we?
Yes, because basically cognitive science is a little bit late to the party. Spent a lot of time studying language, spent a lot of time studying vision, and it's only in recent years that it's come to see how much there is to learn from thinking about music.
I had a wonderful weekend reading your book, Elizabeth. I thank you so much for it, and I could relate to all of it, and I could hear the songs in my head, and I could feel the daydreams that I got to relive and also fantasize about aspects of the future, which you write about as well. I want to thank you for sharing it with us today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Elizabeth Margulis is the professor and the director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. Her new book is out today. Check it out. Transported, the Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams, especially if you love music like me. I want to give a big thanks to our team today. Everybody makes it possible behind the scenes. Jeff Robbins, Claire Nypert, Joel Patnod, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and of course, Larry Mueller, who you can catch throwing out the first pitch at the Madison Mallards game Sunday, June 14th. Get your tickets today because I'm sure he'll be around throughout the game to hang out and talk with you. I would have mentioned the trip to the Barrymore or Bayfield at Bloom, but evidently those are full for now. If the seats become available, we'll let you know. You can find out more details about where you can find Larry this spring and summer online at WPR.org/presents. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.